This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we review the efforts, the multi-pronged efforts of Donald Trump to stay in power.
Constitutional scholar Steve Rohde joins us to analyze the full scope of the January 6th report and its findings.
We also speak with Sharon Kyle, the publisher of the wonderful LA Progressive online newspaper and magazine.
We asked Sharon for her report card on where racial injustice stands in the United States today and what it will take to finally eliminate it from life in America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The January 6th report by the House January 6th Committee has just been published by HarperCollins. It's a page-turner. Most strikingly, the report documents the multi-pronged attack that Trump plotted. The crucial point made by the January 6th Committee report is it demonstrates that it's a profound misconception to view the January 6th invasion of the Capitol as merely a group of Trump supporters gone wild. The plot was not limited to the January 6th violence at the Capitol. Rather, as the report documents, January 6th was a culmination of months of plotting by Trump to overthrow a lawful election and stay in power. He came very close to accomplishing a coup d'etat, a blow against the state. Democracy in the United States, however limited, would have ended. That is what we're going to talk about today with our guest, attorney and constitutional scholar, Steve Rohde. The American Constitution was written in Philadelphia in 1787. Benjamin Franklin was there. When they concluded, Franklin famously said, "We have a republic if we can keep it." Can we keep it? Will Trump be indicted by the Department of Justice and convicted for the criminal activity he orchestrated in order to keep himself in power after losing the election 2 years ago by 7 million votes? If he's not indicted, what will that say and what will be the impact on the future of democracy in the United States? To help us answer these and other questions, we welcome back attorney Steve Rohde. He's recently reviewed the January 6th report with a foreword by Ari Melber in Truthdig and again in the LA Progressive. Steve Rohde is a constitutional scholar, past chair of the ACLU Foundation of California, and author of many books on the Constitution, and a frequent reviewer for the Los Angeles Review of Books. And Mr. Rohde is a leader in the national campaign to free the imprisoned investigative journalist Julian Assange. Steve Rohde, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Steve, let's talk about the multi-pronged attack Trump mounted on our democracy. It involves lawsuits, state legislatures, state government officials, the Department of Justice, and even the military. After all, Trump knew that he lost the election, but nonetheless undertook efforts to stay in power. The committee worked for 16 months and interviewed 1,200 people. They concluded that January 6th, and this is the money quote, they concluded that January 6th, quote, cannot be accurately, substantially split from the long path leading up to it, close quote. Please talk about why this is more than just the January 6th events.
I think that's so important because maybe this committee was misnamed as the January 6th committee. This was a vast conspiracy. It rose to the level of a criminal conspiracy. It was multifaceted. And the January 6th committee report lays that out. If we do nothing more today, I hope people will go online and read at least the 154-page executive summary introduction that's publicly available. The entire report is 845 pages. Many publishers have published the report, and it's available in a variety of settings. The instinctive notion that this was a one-day event where Trump came out, gave an angry speech, inflamed a mob that took over the Capitol is really very limited and short-sighted. There are upwards of 8 different plots. Ari Melber, in his introduction to a HarperCollins edition of the report, lays this out very well. It began before the election. Trump was already threatening that if he lost, he was asked if there would be a peaceful transfer of power, and he said no. There won't be a transfer, frankly. He was clearly planning and plotting this. One of the first things he did was to try lawsuits. Now, lawsuits are legal. We don't consider that a criminal offense. But he filed upwards of 60 lawsuits. He lost all of them but one on a technicality. Having lost those lawsuits, he turned to focus on December 14th. This was a normal day in our electoral process when the Electoral College meets and formalizes, in this case, Biden's victory. But Trump and his lawyers were plotting to find alternate electors who would appear on that day, but that effort failed, and we know that December 14 went by routinely. His next plot was to overturn state elections, and this is where he made the famous phone call to Georgia, but he was also recruiting state officials in Michigan and Arizona. He was doing this under a crazy theory concocted by John Eastman that state officials could overturn the election. That failed, so next he moved on to push the Justice Department to push the states to do the very same thing. He found a mid-level DOJ official, Jeffrey Clark, and they even cooked up a letter to state officials, but that also went nowhere. Finally, around December 18, Michael Flynn and the famous Sidney Powell, the lawyer that Trump found, had a otherwise private meeting at the White House. It went on for hours. They wanted to concoct appointing Sidney Powell as a special prosecutor who would then conscript the military into a coup to seize a voting machine and sabotage the certification. That, of course, went nowhere, although there was paperwork to appoint her. Finally, January 6th was emerging. Here they revived the false elector fraud to try to block the certification on the floor of the Senate. They were not getting Pence's cooperation, and ultimately they were left with an insurrection to do anything they could to stop or halt the certification. And a lot of people ask, why? What was the end game? And this is something that Ari Melber points out. If there was a conflict, if there was a dispute in Congress, the entire election would go to the House of Representatives to decide the election. And the vote in the House was one vote per state, not voting by representative. And while the Democrats had a majority in the House, the Republicans had 26 states. And if they had voted as a bloc, they could have turned the election over to Donald Trump. That's the breadth and the depth of this conspiracy.
Well, and you make very well the point that it wasn't simply a one-off on January 6th, Steve. It was indeed a conspiracy, and you've outlined that for us wonderfully. Its purpose was January 6th to prevent the certification of the election results, but this was a long process, as you've documented. And they almost succeeded, didn't they? How close did they come, do you think?
Well, it's gone unnoticed that the Constitution requires the acceptance and certification on January 6th. That did not happen. because of the insurrection, Congress had to meet on January 7, and in the early morning at 3:40 a.m., finally, Biden's victory was certified. So no one has questioned the legality of that under the circumstances, but to the extent that they caused that delay, they had that small victory, which came at a great price in terms of the crimes that were committed at the Capitol.
Steve Rohde, let's talk about those crimes. The January 6th committee referred four crimes to the Department of Justice for investigation. What are the crimes?
Yeah, the committee report is excellent on this. There are short sections that anyone can read in simple, direct language. There were four referrals of Trump by name to the Department of Justice. Obstruction of an official proceeding to prevent Congress's certification of the election. Each of these has citations to the Federal Criminal Code. The second was conspiracy to defraud the U.S. to overturn the election. The third was conspiracy to make false statements relating to false electors. And the fourth referral was inciting, assisting, or providing aid and comfort to an insurrection. I want to point out that the committee identified, quote, other conspiracies that the DOJ should investigate, including the prevention of someone from accepting or holding office, blocking the enforcement of U.S. law, and obstruction of an investigation by advising witnesses to lie. Finally, what's important about the report is it identifies the fact that the 14th Amendment in Section 3 provides that an individual who took an oath to support the Constitution, but who has, quote, engaged in an insurrection against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies of the Constitution can be disqualified from holding future federal or state office. Now, that has never been implemented. Accordingly, under the 14th Amendment, if implemented, Trump would be disqualified from future federal or state office. Now, that section hasn't been used, and so the committee was recommending that Congress create a formal mechanism, and the committee pointed out that Trump was impeached by the House, and even though he was acquitted in the Senate, a majority of the Senate, 57 votes, would have held him for incitement of the insurrection. So that is a serious charge taken together with the other four referrals.
Steve Rohde, I suspect you'll agree with me when I say that Trump's many lawyers, many of them give the legal profession, well, a bad name. In that regard, talk about the role that, well, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, for example, played. They could be indicted too, couldn't they?
Yes. The committee acknowledges that the DOJ may be in a better position than the committee to investigate co-conspirators, but John Eastman was mentioned personally, prominently in the criminal referrals. John Eastman is at the heart of the illegal attempt, having conceived of various strategies to overcome the election, all of which were debunked, many of which he privately admitted had no basis. John Eastman is facing disciplinary proceedings here in California. Likewise, Rudy Giuliani is referred to and identified by name, along with, by the way, this Jeffrey Clark at the DOJ and Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff. Each of these individuals, by being instrumental in advancing the conspiracy, even if they weren't active in every aspect of it, have criminal exposure, which is very serious.
This is truly remarkable stuff, Steve Rohde. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner and co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with constitutional scholar and litigator Steve Rohde on the January 6th committee report that's just been published. Steve, the people at the Capitol on January 6th were mostly pawns. But it's disturbing that two-thirds of the Republicans still believe that Biden stole the election. Do you think that this figures into Merrick Garland's decision as to whether or not to indict Trump?
Every official, every judge is still a human being. They are influenced by everything around them. I have respect for Merrick Garland. I think, I believe, and I hope he's in the midst of building a bulletproof indictment. He knows, and we all should know, that federal charges must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and he must win a unanimous jury. A single juror in Washington or elsewhere could block conviction. He's appointed a special prosecutor, which I believe was an effective and strategic move to distance himself politically from the recommendation to indict Trump on these four charges or other charges. I'm hopeful the special prosecutor will move expeditiously. He's been handed volumes of evidence and analysis by the committee, but they are doing their own due diligence. And I believe that will allow Merrick Garland to say that my special prosecutor has recommended these charges and I will file them. That's certainly what I hope and expect.
Steve, yes, but if that does not happen, they don't bring Trump to justice, they don't file those charges, what does this say about, the future of our democracy, the future of the Democratic Party currently, and the Justice Department to protect our democracy? What are we left with if there is no indictment of Trump?
It would be a tragedy for American democracy. So far, the system slowly, deliberately has been moving on wherever it can. Led by the Democratic Party, Trump was impeached twice in the House, but because of Republican obstruction, he was not convicted. The Justice Department has charges against 900 insurrectionists. I believe that we have to recognize that our system is designed to be a slow and deliberative system to ensure that the outcome has the confidence of the American people. It ensures due process. The three of us would be on this show emphasizing due process in any criminal case of any political stripe. I believe, therefore, it would be upwards of the worst dereliction of duty for the Department of Justice to blink and not file the charges that we've been outlining. That's why, because of the process, because of the mounting evidence, I remain optimistic. I do not think that we need to have this chapter of American history stained by a failure of will on the part of the Justice Department.
Steve, I read the introduction by Ari Melber. It's brilliant. And I read the 154-page executive summary as well. And I recall Ari Melber saying that if they don't indict Trump, this is just going to be a dress rehearsal for something in the future. What do you think about that observation before I ask you the final question about how people get in touch with you?
Yes, I thought that was a trenchant, incisive observation. It actually has been made by others. It could be a dress rehearsal. If our system cannot hold accountable the highest criminal boss of this conspiracy and all that has flowed from it, then what is to stop future insurrectionists around the country, in state capitals and elsewhere? Frankly, we've seen some of that. This is a time for democracy to stand up and be counted. And I do think the public plays a role in this. You can write to Merrick Garland. You can write to the White House. You can speak to your individual representatives. We need a groundswell calling for justice. And justice in this case means nothing less than seeing to it that Donald Trump is indicted, prosecuted, and the case is laid out for an American jury to decide.
And on that question, Mike was asking Steve about how can our listeners follow your work? You do some wonderful writing, I know, for the LA Review of Books. Talk to us a bit about how people can obtain that information and your work.
Thank you. I do pride myself, if I may say that, on trying to get across to as many audiences these vital issues, whether they relate to the law, to social justice, to racism and white supremacy in this country. Online at the LA Review of Books, Truth Dig, the LA Progressive, all of my material can be accessed on Google. I encourage and would consider it a pleasure for people to read that and circulate that material as they see fit. I think it's by being an informed public, and your radio show contributes to that mightily, that we can uphold justice and reverse so many of the injustices that we're experiencing in this country.
Steve, you've been active in the Julian Assange Defense Committee, and what the government has done in that case by prolonging and really torturing Julian Assange, with the end result being that they're hoping that they'll be able to either convict him or see him die in jail, and that will crush investigative reporting, particularly national security reporting. And I think that I view that as an aspect of this whole terrible decline in American democracy. And I wanted to ask you if you can link up the two, the Julian Assange persecution and the Trump situation, with respect to the decline of democracy in the USA.
Thank you, Michael. I do see a direct link, and it's the kind of link that is monstrous in our system. Merrick Garland today is prosecuting Julian Assange based on an indictment issued under the Trump administration. Initially, the magistrate in England denied extradition based on the fact that Julian Assange faced the risk of suicide if brought to the United States. Merrick Garland and the Biden administration could have dropped that case right there. Instead, they appealed the case, they reversed that decision, they are continuing to prosecute Julian Assange for extradition and prosecution in the United States. That's where the Department of Justice, or injustice in this case, is using its time and resources. I say, drop the charges against Julian Assange, transfer all the lawyers and investigators to the insurrection and the prosecution of Donald Trump. That's when you will deserve the name of the Department of Justice.
Well said.
We've unfortunately run out of our allotted time here on Law and Disorder. Jim and I thank you very much for your consistent good work. You really are steadfast in defending our democratic rights, and we're grateful to your good work and grateful for your coming on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much. You take it easy.
Thank you, and I'm proud of what you do every week to broadcast these programs. It's vital to our democracy and to the search for justice. Thank you both.
Thank you, Steve. So long.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
It's strength to go back to where it all began. It's hard enough to gain an attraction in the rain. You know it's hard to understand, hard to find a way to get through another city day without thinking about
today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at where the long struggle to end racial injustice stands in the United States today. Oh, surely some progress has been made, but to say we've a very long way to go, well, before Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream can be considered realized, is both true and also a sad and gross understatement. A sad commentary on the role that white privilege and racial hatred continues to play in the United States, hundreds of years since our founding. So to help us understand why this is so and what must be done to meaningfully further advance King's dream, we're fortunate to have as our guest today Sharon Kyle. Ms. Kyle is the publisher and co-founder of the LA Progressive, an online newsletter. She is a former president as well as a professor at the People's College of Law, a law school in Los Angeles established by the National Lawyers Guild and other minority bar associations. Sharon Kyle is a member of the board of the ACLU affiliate of Southern California and is its representative to the national board of the ACLU. Sharon Kyle is also an active member of the Los Angeles area Julian Assange Defense Committee, a member of the editorial board of the BlackCommentator.com, and years before immersing herself in the law and social justice work, Sharon Kyle was a member of several spaceflight teams at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Well, Sharon Kyle, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Jim, for having me.
Sharon, as I said in my introduction to this topic, there was certainly, and certainly has been, some progress over the history of the United States where racism and racial injustice is concerned. But to say we've still got a hell of a long way to go is both a gross mischaracterization of the situation and a rather sad commentary. Last month, we again celebrated Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. I wonder, Sharon, if King were alive today, how, in broad strokes, might he characterize just how far we've come and, well, how far we've yet to go to realize his dream of racial equality? What sort of report card grade on the elimination of racism and its impact on our black sisters and brothers might King suggest was appropriate now in 2023?
You know, Jim, I have such a difficult time answering questions about progress, how far have we come? And I think that Dr. King, of course, I cannot speak for him, but I think that Dr. King would also be challenged. I often think of a quote that Malcolm X was famous for saying when he talks about progress. He says, you know, if you stab me in the back 9 inches deep, and you remove the knife, so then it's only 6 inches deep, would that be considered progress? So I think that, you know, we only really need to look at what Dr. King wrote back in the 60s. If you look at his letter from a Birmingham jail, and in his letter from a Birmingham jail, he says, "I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. The Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the Ku Klux Klaner, but the white moderate, who prefers the absence of tension to the presence of justice. And I think that that condition still exists today. You know, we have a tendency to measure our progress based on these heinous acts of cruelty. Right now, what's been in the news, even as of today, is the number of unarmed black people who are killed by police officers, both black and white police officers and Latino police officers. But while that is awful, and while it's so important that the nation address this and eradicate this type of oppressive regime that pretty much occupy urban communities in the United States, we really need to look at what is more harmful in terms of the number of black people who are impacted, and that is the weathering effect of living day to day in a country that easily, that just discriminates, that deprives black people of what everyone else gets. So I think that Dr. King would see the same things that I see.
Sharon Kyle, what role has the continued presence of white privilege played in undercutting racial equality in the United States? Can you give us some examples of how white privilege manifests itself, often in rather subtle ways, as well as in blatantly obvious ways?
Yes, yes. Thank you for that question. In preparation for this, and also because I published the LA Progressive and because I'm a black woman, I kind of always stay on top of this. Also, I'm exposed to it. Well, recently, as recently as 3 months ago, the EEOC, the Economic Equality Commission, has deemed or certified a class action lawsuit be brought against NASA. That is the National Administration for Space Exploration in the United States, an organization that employs tens of thousands, if not 100,000 people, has been systematically discriminating against black people. Now, this is something that has been reported in the news, but you won't see major headlines about this. There is a pervasive, unlooked at, neglected report of discrimination. Oftentimes, the EEOC does not take action. So when they take action, it's really got to be sort of a gross discrimination. And this is what black people live with, and it is stemmed in white privilege. So if this country puts serious resources behind a mission to understand white privilege, much like it has done with space missions, you know, space exploration missions have gotten millions of dollars for space exploration missions. But in a country that is populated by as diverse a population as the United States is, we tend to be woefully illiterate when it comes to issues of white privilege, even understanding white privilege. So in answer to your question, while we may believe that the impact of white privilege is subtle, it is very damaging to broad swaths of the African-American population and indirectly to everyone.
Mm-hmm. You know, Sharon, you mentioned Malcolm X. And I was thinking about that when discussing our two of our nation's preeminent black civil rights leaders, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. Malcolm is generally characterized, of course, as being the more radical, as opposed to King, who was thought of as was more liberal. But by the end of King's life, is it not clear that King himself had, well, become very radical? I'm thinking of his outspoken opposition to the U.S. war in Vietnam, his statement that the United States is one of the most evil nations in history, his embrace of democratic socialism as opposed to capitalism. Am I right about this? And if so, what do you think accounts for King's apparent growing radicalization over the course of his life and work?
You know, I'm just not so sure that his radicalization grew. I suspect that there was a calculated attempt to present Dr. King in a way that was less objectionable to the broader dominant white supremacist culture in the United States. And let's not forget that Dr. King was not embraced by this country during his life. It's only after his murder that he was, and it took a long time, but that he has become this sort of sanitized version of the Dr. King that existed in the years that he was active in the late 50s and 60s. He was not the person that we paint him to be. So I'm not so sure about his growing radicalism, but I do admit that there was a vastly different delivery of messaging between Dr. King and Malcolm X. But it is my understanding from my upbringing, from being in Black communities, and I was a child. I did exist on this planet. I'm old enough that Dr. King was around in my lifetime. But the difference between Malcolm X and Dr. King was basically in the delivery of their message. Malcolm X really appealed to people who were just sick of it and not willing to tone down. He was direct and brilliant. And Dr. King delivered messages that were not as objectionable, but they both were trying to achieve the same thing. So I just don't know, Jim, if I can say that he became more radical. Now, the year before he was assassinated, to the day, April 4th, 1967, he delivered a speech about why we should not be in Vietnam at Riverside Church in New York City. And many people believe that that was the beginning of the end of Dr. King. And not only did he do that in 1967, but in November of 1967, he began the Poor People's Campaign, where he was uniting people of all persuasions who were poor, regardless of your race. And that's when he clearly became a really big threat, just in much the same way that Fred Hampton became a threat. Fred Hampton was a very young Black Panther who could see that the division among the races did nothing more than reduce solidarity, obviously, but it disempowered all of us. And what he did was he created a rainbow coalition that included young patriots, poor whites who were living in Appalachia, Chicago street gangs, Marxist-Leninists, Black Panthers, Latinos. And in doing that, he became a serious threat to the FBI, and he was assassinated.
Sharon, speaking of King's embrace of democratic socialism, whether it came early or later in his life, I don't think it's relevant, although I tend to agree with you that it was early, he just didn't reveal himself. But do you believe that we can ever obtain racial equality in the United States so long as we have a capitalist nation? And of course, powers that be benefit from the great racial and class divides in our country.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I'm no expert on economics, but everything that I've read, my lived experience leads me to believe that our current capitalist system was born out of racism. And there are some scholars that are creating a body of work that falls under the umbrella of racial capitalism. There are many who believe that capitalism as we experience it today would never have existed had it not been the racialization of Black, brown, and indigenous people. Because there has to be a hierarchy. And this hierarchy, with the very few on top, it is legitimized by taking the people at the bottom and making it so that the people at the bottom are less deserving, even though the people at the bottom are the producers of the wealth in this country. So I don't think that it is possible for us to have capitalism without the racial divide. I think racism supports capitalism.
Sharon, for as long as I can remember, leaders in the Black community, as well as others, enlightened folks, have called for reparations for what white America has done and continues to do to our black sisters and brothers. And in recent years, that's been given, I think, a big boost by, well, among others, the powerful Black Lives Matter movement. The demand for reparations has become a bit more pronounced. And in fact, some very modest moves in that direction are now actually taking place. I'm thinking about some small local efforts like in Elliston, Illinois, having to do with affordable housing issues. Your state and my state, California, now has a very active state committee studying the matter of reparations and has, in fact, already released a preliminary report on its work. Critics from the right say, well, reparations for black slavery and all the rest that's going on, it's impossible. You simply can't do it. There are too many questions about the feasibility of creating any kind of reasonable plan. They say, police say it can't and should not be done and so forth. From the other side of the spectrum, to the left, there are many who doubt that reparations are possible as long as we are in a capitalist country. But what are your own thoughts about reparations? What do you think a fair, impactful, and rational plan might look like? What sort of reparations, therefore, should it provide? Who should qualify and so forth? And what about the argument that we will never have anything resembling fair reparations so long as we are a capitalist nation?
Okay, so I'll start by saying that reparations address the legacy of harm caused by state actors. So it's not just slavery. It's slavery and everything that flowed from slavery, including the huge wealth gap between current modern-day African Americans and current modern-day white Americans. That's just one, just to name a few. There's a wealth gap, there's an education gap, there are gaps in health care and so on. So there are several things that could provide transitional justice measures, such as truth and reconciliation commissions. Also, there are several different kinds of institutional reforms that are being looked at. But in the state of California, we have a reparations task force. And the reparations task force came about as the result of an act that was passed by the California legislators, Assembly Bill 3121. And for the past, from September of 2020 until now, the task force has been doing a huge, exhaustive investigation into the lives of current African-Americans and trace back the current African-Americans' experiences with those experiences that trace back to slavery and even back to colonial times. And they made a major report that has 14 key findings. So these 14 key findings made by the California Reparations Task Force are currently available on the California Reparations Task Force website, and I'll just talk about a couple. Number one, from colonial times forward, government at all levels adopted and enshrined white supremacy beliefs and passed laws in order to maintain slavery and other systems of dehumanization and exploitation that stole the life, labor, and liberty and intellect of people of African descent. So this is one of their findings. Again, their findings that come about as the result of an exhaustive two-year investigation. When they talk about white supremacy, because we mentioned white supremacy a little bit in this conversation, but white supremacy is at the core. And white supremacy, while it arose, it was spawned in order for the enslavers to feel that they had the legitimate right to take the life, the labor, the land here in what eventually became the United States, that white supremacy has been enshrined in our legal system and has been institutionalized and still impacts people of color, but specifically African Americans. So do I believe that we need reparations? I think all we have to do is look at the vast differences of the lived experiences that African Americans have and the lived experiences that white Americans have. You know, your listeners may not know this, but my husband is a white man, and I'm a black woman. And I see up close and personal how different we are treated. I was married to a black man. My husband, Dick, is not my first husband. And my first husband was a black man. And just the difference in being out and about in town with him, being pulled over by the police for a minor traffic violation, for example, for not having your tags updated. Such a difference. When Dick is driving, my current husband, who is white, and my former husband, very, very different experiences. But while that's a minor thing, just the emotional toll that it takes walking in black skin in this country tells me that reparations should include an understanding of the impact on our health, the impact on our mental health. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Jim Lafferty, my co-host, my former law partner. We're speaking with the wonderful publisher of the L.A. Progressive, Sharon Kyle. Sharon, Jim and I are both big fans of the L.A. Progressive. We write for it. We share it with our friends and contacts. We've really privileged to have you on our show. Tell us why you and your life partner, Dick Price, who's the editor of the publication, have spent so much of your energy and even your own money putting out the LA Progressive online every day for many years now. And how can our listeners who have not yet become readers, how can they get a hold of the LA Progressive so they can read it like we do?
Oh, thank you so much for that. Well, for listeners that are interested in finding the LA Progressive, they just have to go to laprogressive.com. On the internet, and they'll be taken directly to the LA Progressive. They can subscribe, but if they don't subscribe, you know, if they don't make a monthly payment, we won't stop anyone from reading. It's very important to us that we can share this information, and as you said, we've been publishing it daily now for 15 years, and for the first 10 years, it was completely on our own dime because Dick and I had already raised our children and we had decent paying jobs, so we funded it ourselves. But more importantly, the reason that the LA Progressive came to be is because we felt that our communities lacked the knowledge that they needed around the centering of race. How is it that the progressive community is so splintered? I am a big proponent in the belief that in order for us to truly have progressive solidarity and to have any power, we have to deal with racism. I work with many white progressives and try to do what we can to bridge these communities, but I continue to see a lack of an appreciation for racism being at the center of our division. You know, many people think that racism is a problem, but it's just a peripheral problem, that global warming is a bigger problem, the failing educational system is a big problem. They have all of these problems that they feel are bigger, but in my mind, while those problems are absolutely essential that we deal with them, we can't deal with them unless we unite the progressive body. And so that's why the LA Progressive exists. Mm-hmm. Dick and I both believe that. We have got to unite people so that we can work on these issues together.
Sharon, flowing from that, and I know this because you and I work, for example, in LA on a number of things, especially the effort to free Julian Assange. In that regard, I know that you're a great believer in the movement for radical change, worrying less about what is needed and not covered in the mainstream media, which I often get into, and paying more attention to independent and progressive online news and views, such as the LA Progressive provides. Talk to us a bit about that. Why is it that you think that the online progressive media now is perhaps more important to our work than the much larger, perhaps, but nevertheless, corporate-owned media?
So, the problem with corporate-owned media is that their message is controlled by the corporations, and the corporations don't want the progressive movement to be empowered to make change. Because if the progressive movement were empowered to make change, we wouldn't have these corporate masters. In my mind, and certainly as a black person, what I've seen is that corporate media never served the black community. When we look at what happened, sadly, what happened with Emmett Till in the 1950s, I think it was 1955, when that terrible thing happened with Emmett Till, and Mamie Till, his mom, decided that she wanted the nation to see this. Well, how did she do that? She didn't go to corporate media because she knew that corporate media would not cover the story. She went to Jet Magazine. Jet Magazine, which was a small operation that provided news to the black community. When you look at what happened with Trayvon Martin, that became a national news story. But how did it become a national news story? Because it was picked up first by social media. Now, mainstream media was approached, but they didn't want to carry the story. So those of us who don't have power and who aren't heavily funded by corporations, we are fortunate enough now to have the internet. And it surprised the heck out of me when Dick and I began to get 100,000 readers. I couldn't believe that just the two of us working at our dining room table with the huge help of all of the writers who contribute, that we're able to reach so many people. But that's the power of the internet. And I think that it is an obligation of progressives to use the power of the internet and stop relying on corporate media. They are not our friends.
Well, Sharon Kyle, I want to thank you. Thank you, first of all, for your work and, of course, for joining us here today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Sharon. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Working class hero.
culture has scared us 20 odd years. And then they expect you to pick a career. But we cannot function, we are so full of fear. Keep us doped on religion, sex and TV. And they make you feel clever and classless and free. Got us all still being peasants, as far as I can see. Working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something. At the top, they are telling us still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the Fontainebleau, something to be. Working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, then just